Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. On today's show, we'll look at music from two different but equally passionate perspectives. Our first guest is Grammy-winning, platinum album-selling saxophonist David Sanborn. Now, even if jazz isn't your go-to music genre, chances are great that you've seen or heard this influential artist, possibly as the host of Night Music on NBC in the 80s, or as a featured soloist on one of his countless collaborations with artists like David Bowie, Eric Clapton, and Paul Simon. Then it's time for a crash course in clawhammer with banjo player Bob Carlin. Bob's roots are in North Carolina traditional music, but his musical path has led him to research the banjo's beginnings, which can be traced back to West Africa. He's bringing his musical knowledge to the Muddy Creek Cafe. Then we'll close out the show with Generation Listen, Cringe Con 2, and Hook and Hastings. If any of that sounds new to you, well, stay tuned after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. Later this hour, we'll get schooled on the banjo with Bob Carlin. Bob's an international clawhammer banjo player, lecturer, and producer. The Fiddle and Bow Society are bringing him to Muddy Creek Cafe for a performance. Then associate producer Bethany Chafin and Kike Rodriguez Pastor join me for a super heroic installment of Triad To Do. But first, Triad Arts executive producer David Ford has a conversation with a saxophone player who has released 24 albums, won 6 Grammys, has 8 gold albums, and 1 platinum album. He also happens to be a hero of Mr. Ford's. His name is David Sanborn. David Sanborn is coming to High Point, North Carolina to perform at the 5th annual John Coltrane International Jazz and Blues Festival on Labor Day weekend. He's playing on Saturday, September 5th in support of his new album, Time and the River.
I want to get listeners up to speed, just briefly, David, on your entree into this great world of music. And you know, I've heard and read that your intro to the sax was to help strengthen your chest muscles after an 8-year bout with polio. You began playing around 10 or 11, and then a few years later, as a 14-year-old, you're already performing with professional musicians like Chicago bluesman Albert King. And I wonder if you could just recall for us what your connection to the instrument was like for you at that time, as a young teen.
Well, I mean, it was actually... I had polio when I was 3, and I was in an iron lung for about almost a year, and then paralyzed from the neck down for about a year after that. So in my early childhood was, you know, a bit of a struggle. And, you know, music was just very important to me and all through my life, because it was kind of this, represented this other place that I could go to in my mind that was, you know, I remember lying in bed late at night with all the lights off listening to the radio. And, you know, I grew up in St. Louis, so we would get stations from Chicago and Memphis and Texas and Arkansas and all different places. So I heard country music, early rhythm and blues, jazz, you know, all kinds of music. And it just was, it was so important to me to kind of be this other world that I could inhabit, that was just very attractive to me. And then when I got to be 11 years old and the doctors recommended that I play a wind instrument for therapy, because I'd heard, you know, all these great saxophone players on all the early rock and roll records, like, you know, Fats Domino, Little Richard, and then as well as the jazz players, especially the kind of the more soul jazz players, like the guys in the Ray Charles band, Hank Crawford and David Newman. And I just said, well, I want to play the saxophone. So there you go. I mean, the irony is that if I hadn't had polio, I probably would not have become a musician. So it all works out.
Yeah. Some irony for me back in the Chicago days, in that when... I know you've said before that the first real big influence on your alto sound was the late, great Hank Crawford, and I love his sound as well. And I thought it was funny that when I heard him play in Chicago, again, going back to the 80s, he was billing himself then as the originator of the David Sanborn sound.
Well, he absolutely was.
Yeah. What about his sound particularly grabbed your ears? And you know, get wonky with me if you want.
He just had this incredible human quality to his playing, to his sound. It was like a cry. And I think he was just so expressive as a player. He could play one note and just give it so much meaning. And the minute he started playing, you knew it was him.
Mm.
And I think, only in retrospect do I realize that, you know, that having a point of view is really essential to a player. I mean, you have to have, because, I mean, what we do as musicians, we're storytellers. We tell stories, and everybody's story is different. You know, you tell it from your perspective. So, I mean, if I continued to try to emulate Hank Crawford through my whole life, then I'd be telling his story. So at some point, even though he was a major influence and a foundation of what I built my playing on, at some point I had to move on, because I had other influence as well, as did he. So, I mean, he was influenced by a whole group of people, and he was kind of representative of an amalgamation of his influences, as I did mine. He was just the central, you know, he was certainly the beginning of it for me. He was the foundation on which I built everything else. But I was influenced by a lot of people, a lot of tenor players, you know, a lot of the soul tenor players, Gene Ammons and Arnett Cobb, and people from Texas. You know, they used to call them ball walkers. You know, guys who would get up there, and the honkers and squealers. Like, they played on the early rock and roll records, blues records, all the way up through King Curtis and Junior Walker and people like that. You know, but I was tremendously influenced by a whole wide range of players, more on the kind of earthy, bluesy end of the spectrum. And Hank was just the most prominent influence on me. David Fathead Newman was also almost equally as much of an influence on me.
I'm glad you mentioned tenor playing too, David, because I think well, your sound is obviously so unique, and you, from my ears, you get that full body through the entire range, you know, that nice core warmth in the sound, but then that incredible clarity of the bright edge too. So it's happening simultaneously. Was that a conscious decision on your part, or how did that develop in terms of that aspect of your sound?
Well, I mean, with the exception of Hank, most of my influences were tenor players.
Hmm.
So I was really, and I probably, if it hadn't been too much horn for me to handle at 11 years old, probably would have played the tenor.
How about that?
You know, and so I thought, you know, I think all along that I was really trying, going after a tenor sound and a tenor approach to playing, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Hank kind of fit in that point of view for me, because he was just, there was something else to his sound that was less what I considered to be alto-like at that sound. Maybe it was just the bluesy kind of gospel aspect of it. But outside of him, I think that the guys that were influences on me were tenor players. So I kind of gravitated toward that kind of conception. And I think that, unconsciously at least, the sound that I had in my head had a lot of that bottom end of the frequency in it.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
So I think that rather than thinking on the upper end of the sonic spectrum of sound, I was going after the, you know, the bottom end of the sound. So that's, I think, as important or maybe even more important than the top end. I mean, the top end, the brightness, was almost a defense against, like, you know, playing with electric bands. You got to kind of cut through. I mean, I always liked that edge. Because I heard players like Phil Woods, who was a very percussive player.
Yeah.
And certainly Cannonball, you know, had that, you know, that edge to their sound, even though they played very different setups from me.
I know a lot of our listeners who may not be familiar with David Sanborn albums could probably hum along to dozens of your incredible solos as a sideman on other artists' recordings. We're here in North Carolina. I'll throw out James Taylor's You Make It Easy, Stevie Wonder's Talking Book, and David Bowie's Young American as another, just to name a few. And I've always wondered how you're able to so consistently capture the essence of an entire song in one little 8-bar solo, especially in a recording studio with, you know, the clock ticking away. And I wonder if you could share your mindset going into those situations.
I mean, so much of it is just instinct and not conscious decisions. It's just, I think it's more just kind of immersing yourself in the character of the song. And, you know, and that probably speaks back to my childhood of, like, going to this place in whatever song I was listening to that was, you know, wanting to be kind of in, wanting to inhabit the song and have it kind of envelop me. And so, I mean, I think that as a general perspective about music has always been the case with me. You know, when I play, it's very not analytical for me. You know, I'm kind of just responding to the ambience of the song. You know, it's not just notes on a page or trying to think about it clinically. You know, I don't know any other way to describe it. And I mean, I think, you know, after the fact, I can say, okay, well, I did this and I did that. You know, I mean, I think the function of playing a solo on somebody else's record, particularly a vocalist, is you've got this space, usually after a good portion of the song goes by, where you can, you know, what your job is to connect one part of the song to another part of the song. So you're like a bridge between two parts of the song. So, you know, depending on what preceded you and what comes after your solo, I think is, you know, how you connect those two sections. So you try to keep the momentum going, but you also try to be in the character of the song and reflect some kind of the melodic harmonic content of the song in your solo. I mean, that particular solo, the James Taylor solo, was, you know, it's so easy because his melody was so strong. So I was just kind of paraphrasing his melody. That, to me, was the right thing to do in that case.
Whoa. Yeah.
And I mean, often, like, especially on pop records, you kind of try to do that. I mean, that's not a hard and fast rule, but you maybe do some variation of the melody, some interpretation of the melody. There's another song I played on a Carly Simon record called You Belong to Me. It was the same thing. I kind of paraphrased the melody a little bit and then kind of followed the harmonic contours of what happened after that and connected one section of the song to the other section of the song. So I think as a, you know, soloist, that's what you are. You're a connector. You know, and in Bowie's case, I kind of set up the vibe of the song. You know, I mean, my job, actually, in that situation, you know, Bowie was a saxophone player. He was an alto player.
Right.
And on that record, on the Young Americans album and that song, but particularly on the whole record, he said, okay, my idea for this record is we're going to have rhythm guitar, bass, drums, and some keyboards. And what my job was, he said, I want you to kind of perform the function of a lead guitar player. So instead of lead guitar, it's going to be you. So you're going to play all that stuff that normally a lead guitar player would play, the fills and the, you know, the solos and all that stuff. So that was kind of my role in that circumstance. So I always think of myself as a member of the rhythm section. I mean, even in my own music, it's not like me with the band backing me up. I'm part of the band, part of the rhythm section. So my interaction with all the other musicians in the band is essential. you know, it's not, I don't want to fill every space. You know, you have to bounce off people and leave a little space and let something else happen in order to allow what you do to have any kind of meaning. You know, it's got to have some kind of rhythmic momentum to it. And if you're playing every single note all the time, it just gets tedious and a little bogged down. Like, I mean, these are just like little psychological approaches that I have to playing.
Well, I appreciate hearing them. I think it's really, for me, this is really fascinating stuff.
So I think of myself as part of the rhythm section.
Yeah. I want to talk about the new album, to let listeners know about it, because it sounds so great. And another session cat back there, very adept at being a part of the band and stepping out front when needed and in the background when not, was certainly Marcus Miller. And you'll be performing with him, of course, you do on the new album, Time and the River, and then coming up here at the John Coltrane International Jazz and Blues Festival. Before we dive into the album itself, David, how has your relationship with Marcus evolved over the years, say?
Well, I first met Marcus when he played on one or two tracks of an album I called Hideaway.
Yep.
And then we were in the Saturday Night Live band together for a while, and then he joined my band. He was on the road with me for several years and began writing songs for my records. At that time, was not producing. And I just loved his demos so much and the way that he, you know, the sound that he got on the production sound that he got on his demos, that gradually he became, you know, he would produce maybe a couple of songs on the record, and then he gradually kind of, you know, segued into actually producing the records. And we had for a long time, a very fruitful relationship, because we were, you know, we would actually go into the studio with no idea what we were going to do. And at that time, it was practical to do that, just to write in the studio. Your studio time was not that expensive. And, you know, we had, you know, just the freedom to do that. And it was great because we would come up with these ideas and kind of, you know, put them down, record them, and then just build on them. And it was an interesting process. And over that period of time, we developed a real, you know, good working rapport and kind of a shorthand with communicating with each other that I think has continued to this day. So even if there are long stretches of time when we don't see each other, it's an easy kind of rhythm to fall back into with him.
He's spoken often about how much he got from you as a musician and composer, actually beginning with that great collaboration on your album, Voyeur, and what a great collaboration that was.
Well, I mean, he didn't get anything more from me than I got from him. I mean, I think it was a very symbiotic relationship, and I actually feel that I certainly got more from him than he ever got from me, but, you know, that's my perspective on it.
Well, you've got your first recording project with him in Time and the River in, I guess, 15 years. I'm imagining that's sort of like riding a bike, getting back into that groove. But let's talk a little bit about the album and Time and the River. I like the title. Several of the tunes sound reflective, and I really enjoy them. How did that title come up?
You know, I don't know. It's just kind of the way all of them come up. They just kind of rise to the surface. And I mean, there were a lot of kind of, you know, tie-ins with this. I mean, after the fact, I can kind of construct an explanation for you. But, I mean, maybe unconsciously, you know, because I grew up on the Mississippi River in St. Louis. I moved to New York, on the Hudson River. And now I just moved up to Westchester, right on the Hudson River as well. So I've spent really all my life living close to the river. You know, a river, two of the major rivers in America, the Mississippi and the Hudson. So, you know, and just the passage of time and, you know, the metaphor of water moving, time passing. Ironically, the Japanese symbol that's on the cover, which is a symbol for river, it's three vertical lines.
Yeah.
Is also, and kanji in Japanese, the possessive form of three is sanbon, which is like kind of,
oh,
sound very similar to sanborn. So, I mean, there was a lot of congruity there, just it all kind of a lot of things tied together. I don't know how. That's a little cutesy, but.
Listen, I mean, it's a great story. The global nature of that little association you mentioned there, I'm thinking of the first tune, A La Vertical, and great global grooves going on here. And as always, I mean, your sound fits into the mix so perfectly here. It's a great aggressive playing we're talking about, you know, the Phil Wood style, a lot of edge and attitude. Has your approach to big recording projects like this one changed over the past 20, 30 years? I mean, this is a big one. This is a nice one.
Well, there's some kind of focus for the record. I mean, you know, some elements that are, you know, whether they're textural or melodic or the ambience of a record or whatever it is. I mean, I think this one, it was very percussion-oriented. So I don't know if you noticed, the percussion are mixed way up.
Yeah.
You know, and then the interaction, there's percussion on every song. And it's always fairly prominent.
But the balance works great. I mean, again, you were talking earlier about the percussive style of alto saxophone playing and likening it to Phil Woods. And here it is in a context that I've been following your career for years. I don't think I've ever heard that texture to that extent in any recording. It's really something new and exciting.
Well, I think having that kind of ambience to the tracks allowed me to kind of lay back a little more and not play as dense as I, you know, because I don't really like playing a lot of notes. I mean, it just, the older I get, the more and more I kind of back off from, you know, filling space. I'm trying to leave more space. I think it's, at least for my sensibility, more musical. And I think it has, for me, my function in any ensemble has more impact if it's done, you know, with an eye toward being a little more sparing.
That sparing quality or the space between the notes comes out big time in Ordinary People, the track that follows, and I love this that earnest quality and your playing on this tune. It made me think back to some of your earlier beautiful recordings of a song like Lisa or Lotus Blossom. And it's another of your longtime collaborators on the album. Ricky Peterson adds some nice texture with the B3. What's it been like working with Ricky over the past 20-plus years?
Well, Ricky is really good at finding these interesting textures. And he's just very musical. He's got the ability to surround whatever it is that you're doing with the appropriate kind of ambience. And it's, you know, having that kind of history with somebody who knows you're playing so well, they kind of just almost, it's second nature for them to know what to do when they hear you do something. Not that they know exactly what you're going to play to follow up, but it's easier to have a dialogue with somebody that you're used to conversing with, because that's really what this all is about. It's about a conversation, you know. So your relationship with another musician in the tune is the nature of a conversation. When you're talking about, you know, with somebody who you have a history with, it's usually a richer, you know, in meaning conversation.
The way you emote on this tune is so conversational, as if you're singing this, and I like the way you leave in. I'm listening carefully in the headphones, and I'm hearing these raw sounds of like wet reed meeting your mouth. It's like a singer's breath, you know, you hear just against the mouth.
That is very important to me, and I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, a lot of times recording engineers will say, oh, no, we got a little click there, or we heard a little, you know, breath, or we heard, you know, the wetness of the reed, and we want to clean it up. Well, don't clean it up. That's like, you know, it's like sanitizing your inside of your mouth, you know, Windex it. You know, I mean, don't clean it up. That's what's human. That's the human part of it. You know, I love it when you can hear a singer like breathing in.
Oh, yeah.
You know, hear a little crack in their voice, or, you know, hear them. you know, that to me is like, because this, what, you know, that's what it's all about. It's not about the notes. It's about the texture and the shape and the color and the, you know, it's just like, you know, if you change the key of a song, you change its nature. Certain songs, and especially, you know, played on, you know, saxophone. I mean, my big problem is I write, a lot of the songs I write are in terrible keys for the alto. But if I change the key of the song, it changes the nature of the song. So I'm stuck. So I have to figure out a way to make them work in that key. You know, because I'm always in, like, concert B, which is, you know, G sharp, you know, 8, 9 sharps, 42 flats, you know. Like, wow. Certain tunes just work. You know what I mean? It's just that's where they are. I mean, it's, if you change the key, it doesn't mean that the tune is not going to work in another key, but you have to approach it a different way. It's just another factor in the song. And, you know, just kind of how that relates to all the excess, what some people would call excess sound in a note, whether it's that, you know, the wet reed or the, you know, intake of breath or whatever it is. That's the part you want to leave in. That's the humanity.
I love the way you've referenced this 2 or 3 times, David, this element of being in the moment, listening, focusing, same sorts of phraseology coming out of Wayne Shorter in a conversation with him, just the amount of listening that goes into a commitment to the moment. And I just love that aspect of what you do.
Yeah, well, I think it's essential. And the older I get, the more I see that that's really the essence of what this is that we do as musicians. We commit to the moment. And I mean, in a way, that's, you know, I don't mean to get all loopy about it, but it's kind of a spiritual state. You know, it's like a state of grace. You know, you're in this place where you're, it's like, you know, you're totally in the moment. And when you're in the moment, then all your training as a musician becomes just part of what you draw on to play whatever's appropriate to that moment, whatever it is that you're hearing in that moment. And, you know, that doesn't minimize all the work that you've done, all the practice, but you don't practice in order to get licks together. You know, I mean, if you're going to play something you played before, it's going to be naturally something that happens as a result of whatever's appropriate to that moment.
Well, David Sanborn, thank you again for your dedication to what you've done over the decades and all the hundreds, if not thousands, of hours of just happiness that you've given me and so many of my friends and along the way. Thank you, and thanks for taking time.
Well, thank you very much.
David Sanborn. He's playing at the 5th Annual John Coltrane International Jazz and Blues Festival in High Point. The festival is on September 5th and 6th and features touring and local jazz and blues artists including Earl Clue, Pancho Sanchez, and Marcus Miller. Be sure to tune in to Triad Arts Weekend next week for David's interview with the Grammy-winning multi-instrumentalist and producer Marcus Miller. Coincidentally, Marcus produced David Sanborn's latest album, Time and the River. For tickets to the 5th Annual John Coltrane International Jazz and Blues Festival and more music from David Sanborn, visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll explore the detailed craftsmanship and musicianship of the banjo with Bob Carlin. Next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. Be sure to stick around till the end of the show for Triad To Do. It's where we pick the brains of our producers and contributors and pass the eclectic information on to you. The list making starts about 15 minutes from now. Bob Carlin is a clawhammer banjo player that calls Lexington, North Carolina home. He has toured internationally and produced many albums under the traditional music umbrella. He has four albums of his own on the Rounder record label, and you have a chance to see him perform some of that music live at the Muddy Creek Cafe on Friday, August 21st. The concert is presented by the Fiddle and Bow Society. He spoke with Triad Arts executive producer David Ford, and he brought along his banjo.
First, describe this banjo for me. What are we looking at here?
Well, this banjo actually has some of its roots in North Carolina.
All right.
Because the current style or features or popular banjo for what we call old-time music or the music that came before bluegrass, the difference is bluegrass music. And it's too bad you guys can't see me, but bluegrass music used a finger-picking style, right? An up-picking style, thumb and two fingers, mm-hmm. which was codified, pioneered, whatever, by Earl Scruggs, the boy from outside of Shelby, and who was first with Monroe on the Grand Ole Opry and then with Flat and Scruggs. And of course, they're famous for the Beverly Hillbillies and the theme for the Bonnie and Clyde. So that came from North Carolina, and that music that Earl helped invent with Bill Monroe was like jazz. People took solos. There was some ensemble playing. There was solo playing. It was a performance music. The music that came before that was more of a home music. And if any of you have read some of my writings, like in the book String Bands in the North Carolina Piedmont, published here in North Carolina by McFarland, wonderful press up there in the mountains, that music was more of a home-based music, and the transition was just starting to happen to where it was a performance-style music. Hmm. So, but now the revivalists, air quotes, who are now playing whatever descendants there are of the music, the sound that they're looking for is based on the instruments made by this guy Kyle Creed, who was from originally the Round Peak area between Galax and Mount Airy, North Carolina. And Kyle built banjos, in fact, built about 100 and 200 banjos, or made necks for existing pots, banjo pots, banjo rims, back in the 60s and 70s. And in fact, there's a Round Peak banjo company now honors that and makes Kyle Creed, not copies exactly, but very inspired by Kyle, banjos. And they do a Kyle Creed festival every year or so, and that's going to be this fall, just as a point of note. But that's the popular sound right now. 12-inch pot, which mm-hmm. is what this banjo has, right. A scale, so it throws the bridge more towards the center of the instrument, so it makes it have more of a sonorous, more of a wider range, frequency response, more mids, more sustain, and a few other features as well.
Bob, is that pot covered with a leather top, or is that plastic? What is
it? No, this is actually plastic, but it's a type of plastic that was invented to be used on timpani drums, believe it or not, and it seemed to work for banjos. So that's also a favorite these days. Mm-hmm. And so this is actually a Bob Carlin BC350 gold tone banjo. I've designed four instruments based on Kyle's designs for a gold tone. It was the first manufactured in the modern age, made in a factory, 12-inch pot Kyle type banjo, and luckily it worked and it sold, or else you wouldn't know who I was probably today. I'd be working in a cafe somewhere, you know.
What do you love about the sound of this instrument? Could you describe, for the non-banjo player, mm-hmm. non-musician even, yeah. what do you love about it?
The wide frequency range and the sustain and
just that much, before we go on, you say the wide frequency range, I imagine for someone who knows nothing about music, they say, what does that mean?
If you hear, it's got definition in the high end and high overtones. But it's got lots of low end as well, bass response. It's also, you know, it's kind of like in Spinal Tap. He goes away, come away, come back. You know, it's still, you know, it's that sort of thing.
I love it.
It sustains.
That's what I love so much about Marcus Miller's bass sound.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a combination of the whole spectrum. He's got that oomph and that warmth of the bass, but a really beautiful timbre, crystally clear top.
Yeah.
You get
them
both in that.
Well, I was a bass player, not a great one like Marcus, but I was a bass player for a while. And with solo performing, you've got to fill a very big space.
Hmm.
And, of course, we were talking about how John Hartford was such a great solo performer before. And I was out there trying to tread the same boards, not at the for the audience's the size that he was, but still I was trying to fill some of that same space.
That sonic space. It's just you and your instrument on stage.
It's not just the sonic space. It's also to keep the audience's attention and to give variety. And so you need an instrument that's got the ability to do that and just doesn't have one sound.
Yeah. Take me back. And Bob, only you could solve this mystery for me. I've heard this approach so many different ways. The very beginnings of the banjo, where did it come from? I'm not going to say anything more. Take us back.
Well, you know, get a copy of my book. Just shameless plug number two.
No, this is the birth of the banjo.
Yes. Yeah. Again, also published by McFarland.
Yeah.
That book outlined some of it, but we're fairly well convinced now that it's an African instrument.
Okay.
That at least the archetypes come from West Africa, where the majority of American slaves came from, and that the lutes of West Africa somehow were transformed here in the New World into what we know now as a banjo.
Okay.
And codified, probably passed into white hands, so it was being played by blacks and whites probably by 1800, and then by the 1840s it codified and went from being thought of, at least represented as a gourd band instrument, gourd bodied, to being a frame or a drum-looking instrument. Now, this is not a drum. It's a lute. It's a West African-derived lute, and derived from West African lutes. And so, you know, people go, oh, it's a rhythmical instrument. Because it's got the drum. You know, it's got the drum. And it's
now
like,
I think about it, yeah.
Yeah, you know, wow.
It's a snare drum.
But it's not a snare drum, and it's not a drum. It's a lute, and it's got the characteristic of the short string played with your thumb, mm-hmm. that's sometimes played for melody and sometimes played for rhythm, that comes from West Africa.
I think of the kora as being an instrument like that where you play with your thumb.
Yeah, but the kora is a harp.
Okay.
And it's a much newer instrument. The folklorist went up to my friend Shekamalo Djibati, who I recorded a record with for Five String Productions. That's my shameless plug number three. And Shekamala was taking us, I was walking around with him, and he was trying to help these countrymen of his at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival on the Mall. And so a folklorist, who I won't mention her name, she's at Appalachian, but so that probably will tell you who it was. She was filming and said to Shekamala, you know, how old is this instrument? And pointed at the lutes that were there. And he goes, 1,362, you know, 2 weeks, 1 month, 2 weeks, you know, and 6 hours, 3 minutes, which, of course, he was doing the typical West African thing, which is tell her what you think she wants to hear. Tell the white person what they think they want to hear. But it's true. The lutes are about 1,000 years old. The kora is only a couple of hundred years old.
Who knows?
So these are lutes, not harps. And the West Africans strike down, but they also pick up on the string. They go back and forth, and the thumb will also play some of the strings.
Gotcha.
And that's in the sort of the classical style, the griot style, the jelly style. And then the folk style, it's all pretty much downpicked.
Okay.
And so that's where that comes from. It's not a style really found anywhere else. And so that style translates over to the earliest American banjo playing, which downstriking, right, with the nail of either the index or the middle of the right hand has become the codified version. And that we call claw hammer or frailing or banging or knocking or old time or whatever.
Could you play the same phrase for me, Bob, doing a claw hammer style or down picking style and then follow it immediately with the reverse, a bluegrass style up-picking, just the same thing.
I can't play bluegrass, but let me see if I can do this. you'd play. Now that's up-picked, and it's more of a two-finger up-pick, that transitional style.
Let's go, if you don't mind, just doing that up-pick thing first and then follow it with the down-pick. So the up-pick is a little more flesh on the string, a little more warmth to the attack.
Well, yeah, because you're using some of the flesh of your finger rather than the nail.
There you go. Who knows? Yeah. I mean, for you, this is all, you don't even think about it. But for me, this is the first time I've really had it broken down that easily.
I mean, it gets very complicated if you look at the real thing, if you look at really what's going on the ground, because you went from the claw hammer, right, to people doing, or, rhythm, to doing it as an up-pick, because they heard people doing three finger style, but this was way before Earl, and that style was called classic. It was introduced from the guitar over to the banjo to try to elevate the banjo and get it out of the public's perception as being a African-American black slave instrument. And this happened, all these forces coincided in the late 19th century to make this happen, because they could mass produce instruments for the first time. Mm. So they needed to sell more. And the middle class was burgeoning at that time as well. So people had leisure, they had money. So the banjo became marketed as a instrument that young ladies could play and college students could play. And there was a big boom of it. But it was doing this, three-finger up-pick style that influenced country style. And so guys who had been doing this, some of them wanted to just reversed it and did an up-pick at the beginning. Some of them did two fingers, because that's all the fingers they would use to do the claw hammer. And some of them did two finger, and then when Earl came along, they tried to add the third finger. And so you have all this back and forth going on between popular culture and folk culture, even to this day.
I don't need work, I need money. I don't need work, I need money. I'm not the first, but I am the worst. I don't need.
Is this a fair? You raise the name Scruggs, and I've got to go there with you, because I'm still learning about this great man and Doc Watson. But is it a fair comparison to say what Charlie Parker was to jazz, Earl Scruggs was to this music, and what did he bring that you just still today go, wow, that this is just a beyond? His name comes up again and again and again in the tradition.
Well, part of it is that he was in the right place at the right time. It's like arguments that persist to this day about, Hartford has a line in a song he wrote about Earl, or that was kind of Earl's story, called The Boys from North Carolina. And he says, still talking about who played it first. Was it Don Reno? Was it Earl? Was it Snuffy Jenkins? The problem is it's like with the argument about who played melodic bluegrass style first, which is playing the notes of the fiddle tunes and all of the embellishments, instead of working out of a roll like Earl did. It was working out of patterns where you went from a lower string to a higher string, but the melody went from a lower to a higher in the reverse of what you were doing on the strings. I don't know if I can explain it any other way than that, but Bill Keith is the one who's often credited with that, and lately there's been a lot of contention that Bobby Thompson from South Carolina was the first one, or Carol Best from Western North Carolina was the first one. But of course, it's irrelevant who was the first one. If nobody heard them and they had no influence, it's really ultimately the one that people heard. So Earl was with Monroe on the most powerful station, WSM, out of Nashville, Grand Ole Opry, in the late 40s, mid-late 40s, right after the war. So he was the one that everybody heard and everybody imitated. Whether or not these other guys did it first, it doesn't matter.
Gotcha.
It does matter, and we want to give him credit. But really, Earl's his version of it, he took something and codified it into something very different. This standard role where he works the melody into his role and plays the melody with either his thumb, his index, or his middle. In other words, he moves the melody around. Whereas other people in the past would play all the melody with their thumb or all the melody with their index.
That's one I would love for you to demonstrate, Bob. If you would just,
I don't know
and
if
you
I
can.
Can.
Slow it down as
I
much as you
can. I can't really
need
play Earl's style, but let's say thumb lead would be. So every other note's the thumb. Right?
Gotcha.
And Earl, so he'd be playing a roll. I don't think I can do this. I'm not doing it right, but, you know, you move the melody wherever the roll keeps going. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1,
there, right? You know, he's not gotten it.
But this is, I'm trying to simplify it. And so the melody sometimes note might be on the thumb, sometimes it might be on the index, sometimes it might be on the middle.
Okay.
So the melody moves between the strings, but the one finger doesn't, or the thumb doesn't follow it. You keep the roll going.
Okay.
And so that was the big difference. And it created a real drive in the music, which it didn't have before. And Earl just has this real musicality to knowing which notes to choose, you know, which melody notes to choose to put to keep in and which ones to exclude to keep the roll going.
Bob Carlin. He's playing at the Muddy Creek Cafe in Bethania Mill on Friday, August 21st. The concert is presented by the Fiddle and Bow Society. On September 12th, Bob will be lecturing on North Carolina banjo traditions at the Earl Scruggs Center. That's in Shelby. You'll find more on Bob and the Fiddle and Bow Society at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. We have one more break, but when we return, we fill up your to-do list with some fun, heroic, and off-the-beaten-path triad tips when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome to Triad To Do. I'm Eddie Garcia, here today with Bethany Chafin.
Hey, everyone.
And Kike Rodriguez-Pastor.
Howdy.
How's everyone doing?
I'm doing good.
And so what do we have this week, Bethany?
Yes, we have something coming up next week, which is really exciting. So I'm doing a little in-house promotion for this. We're having another listening party, and some of you were at our first in May. That was part of NPR's listening tour. But now here's another one. We're going to be doing it at Geeksboro Coffee House Cinema, a great venue in Greensboro. And we're going to be listening to an episode of This American Life in anticipation of Ira Glass's appearance here in town in Greensboro in September.
A lot of people are excited about that.
They are. Yeah. I'm really looking forward to it. So this episode's a lot of fun. We look into invisibility versus the power of flight, comics that didn't quite make it. Kind of like you're talking about the Fantastic Four movie that didn't take off. How about in the comic book industry, the ones that didn't quite take off and why? So it's going to be a lot of fun. It's an opportunity to listen in an intimate setting, get to know the people who are there, talk about what you're hearing. A lot of times people listen alone, and we're trying to make it a community event again. So we're looking forward to sharing this episode with you and chatting about your ideas. So what about you guys, flight or invisibility?
Flight.
Put you on the spot. Flight. Okay, flight. Eddie?
Invisibility.
Okay, well, you can come to this event and tell us which superpower you would prefer. That is going to be Thursday, August 27th at 7 p.m. at Geeksboro Cinema. We hope to see you there. So, Kike, how about you? What do you have?
All right, well, I'm a creature of habit, and when I think about, seeing what's going on the weekends, I just typically, by default, I go, well, what's going on at the garage? What's going on at Reanimator? Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in seeing local bands. And I thought, let's branch out a little bit. We live in the city of arts and innovation. Let's see what else is cooking. So I did some digging around, and I saw a really cool event. It's part of a series called Sounds of the Summer. And they explore the tones and colors of organs in Winston-Salem. And this is going to be the final concert of the series. And what intrigued me about it is that it's not just a performance. It's not just an organ performance, but it's actually part of the event is the exploration of the instrument. And this particular organ is a Hook and Hastings organ, originally built on the 19th century in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And it moved to Winston for restoration and renovation. And it's apparently among organ lovers is considered the latest gem in the city. And I thought, that's perfect. I know nothing about that.
Yeah, and where is that at?
It'll happen at St. Timothy's Episcopal Church on Monday at 7 o'clock. That's here in Winston-Salem.
Cool.
Yeah. All right, so Eddie, tell us, what do you got going on?
Well, I'm going to bring it back around to superheroes and supervillains a little bit. next weekend at Reanimator Records and on the block of Reanimator, they're having the second annual Cringe Con. And what Cringe Con is, it's a, like a weirdo music festival and superhero villain costume party. And it expanded from last year where it was just, it's a one evening event at the garage with like four bands and people were encouraged to wear costumes and invent their own superhero characters. Mm-hmm. And this year it's starting in the afternoon out in the streets in front of Reanimator Records in downtown Winston-Salem. And there are some local bands playing like Primo Van Halen and Tetragrammaton, and there's people coming from all over, including, if you're into experimental or outsider music, kind of a legend, Eugene Chadbourne. I don't know if either of you have ever heard of him, but he's done stuff as far-flung as collaborating with the Violent Femmes to just playing like weird solo guitars to actually, he's known for this instance where he played a guitar solo on a rake. You can look it up on YouTube.
Cool.
But yeah, he's pretty cool, and I've seen him a couple times in the area, but it's been quite a while since he's been around. There'll also be a couple of bands that perform with puppets, like with a puppet show. Huh. On the other end, there's this incredible guitar player named Yes the Raven, who's a smooth finger-picking guy.
Irish fellow, right?
Yeah, the Irish guy. He's part of it, too. So it's music on the fringes and just music on the outside of what people might usually check out.
Nice.
And also a costume party. So yeah, that's Saturday, August 29th. Starts around 4 p.m., and it's a $5 suggested donation.
Cool.
That sounds like a
very
lot of fun.
Neat.
Yeah.
And for more information about anything you hear on Try It To Do, just visit us on Facebook or at WFDD.org. Triad Arts Weekend's executive producer is David Ford. Our associate producers are Bethany Chafin and Kike Rodriguez-Pastor. You'll find podcasts, archived episodes, and links to our guests, events, videos, and more on our website, WFDD.org. Once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can follow us on Twitter as well. Our handle is Triad Art Speak. And be sure to like WFDD on Facebook. Triad Arts Weekend is a production of 88.5 WFDD, public radio for the Piedmont. I'm Eddie Garcia. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.